Thank you, David. I'm here at Stowe Town Hall as the result for the Middle England constituency of Buckingham and Northampton has just this very moment been announced. The Labour candidate, Sir Keith Stannings, actually coming to the microphone to speak right now. Thank you, everyone. It's a great privilege, an enormous responsibility with which I accept this post. I look forward to representing the people of Britain's motorsport heartland in Westminster. I don't want to make hollow promises, but one thing I assure you is that this new Labour government will deliver three British drivers leading the British Grand Prix and a British winner at Silverstone too. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, if Labour can deliver that, maybe there is hope for the country. No. Back to the studio.
Hello and welcome to what is going to be a very happy edition of Gareth Jones on Speed. I'm Gareth and he's Zog.
Hello.
Zog, you're almost certainly as happy as I am because of that glorious race over the weekend at Silverstone.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, that really delivered way beyond expectations. The British Grand Prix tends to be one of the highlights of the year.
Yeah.
For British motorsport fans, it's always a great event. But it was set up so well for a good race with three British drivers, one, two and three at the front of the grid. And we had really good racing, a really genuinely exciting race where you did not know who was going to win and real drama throughout the event. And right at the end, I mean, in the end, it's all about Lewis Hamilton and what an incredible moment that was. What an incredible achievement. By any measure, he's one of the greatest drivers of all time. He's also, you know, second oldest guy in the field at the moment. And, yeah, you know, he's approaching the end of his career. And, of course, you wonder, you know, what does he still have left in him? And there'd be questions this year about whether, given that he's leaving Mercedes, you know, how much are they going to be committed to each other? How much would Lewis really give for the team? And I think we had this discussion. We agreed that, you know, actually we felt he's going to give 100%. The team's going to be behind him all the way. They're going to want to have more success together. And crikey, you know, what they achieved this weekend, just extraordinary. I was in tears at the end of the race. It was, you know, he really added to his legacy as one of the all-time greats in spectacular fashion. He held off Max Verstappen to take the win at the end, and in doing so, he added to his legacy by being the first driver to take 9 wins at the same circuit. Also the first driver, I think, with over 300 Grand Prix under their belt to take a win. What an incredible driver he is. You know, what an extraordinary man he is. What a great inspiration, you know, not just in the world of motorsport, beyond. Absolute star. And that was a true star performance. Yeah, it was incredible. I was in awe.
I particularly enjoyed the deep, tearful element to this. Being a Welshman, of course, I like a bit of happy sad, you know. But often when a driver wins a race, it's all hard slapping at the back and punching the air and kind of aggression and gritted teeth. It's like, I showed you I could win. But it wasn't like that. It was like a relief, wasn't it? It was like coming to terms with things that I can still do it. I mean, it was the hug. It was Lewis's hug with his dad, Anthony. I was full of tears myself.
Of course.
I watched the race on delay because I intended to watch it live, but I woke up, being as this is North Wales, I woke up in a field in North Wales on Sunday morning.
Okay, you know what my next question is. Explain yourself.
Yeah. Well, I went to a festival. I went to the Tonnau Festival, which means the Waves Festival, which is on Ynys Môn, which what we used to call
Anglesey, Ynys Môn. The Ynys means island, Môn is its name. It kind of means mother in some ways. And yeah, I decided after a splendid Friday night in Conwy, where I did a gig to celebrate my birthday, my 63rd birthday, I did a gig, did two songs with a local band. We did Come On Feel the Noise and an On Speed song, OK, back in the UK. Only the second time that's ever been played live in front of an audience. And you were there for the first one, 10 years ago?
Yeah.
So I had a great Friday, a ridiculously late party in my new house for the first time ever. And then Saturday was persuaded to go in the afternoon and visit this festival. So, yeah, I woke up in a field. It wasn't quite as dramatic as it sounds. I woke up in a tent in a field, a very nice tent that my friends had, which they invited me to stay in. So I had to get back from Ynys Môn to Conwy, which isn't a big journey in the grand scheme of things, but public transport is a little lacking in this part of the world, or the frequency of public transport. So I only just got here after the race had started in the afternoon. Luckily, my Skybox, which is now hooked up, was recording, and I was able to queue it up without learning the results. And it was such an exciting race that halfway through it, I deliberately paused it. I thought, hang on a minute, I can't believe what's happening here. Yeah, went, made myself a cup of tea, had a fag, took stock of think, right, what the heck is going to happen in the second half of this race? And exactly as you said, Doug, it really delivered. It was that constant passing and losing of places that made it exciting. And these were superb drivers driving at their very best, doing their level best to go just that microsecond faster than the car in front of them and failing in the changing conditions. And really, once again, I hate to say this, but Bernie Eccleston was right. His plan of spraying circuits with water from a truck full of water fitted with sprays randomly, or having spray heads fitted to certain corners on circuits, would definitely have given us that sort of random factor that we enjoyed at the British Grand Prix this weekend.
Well, it would, although there's a question about whether the means by which you get to that end of having that uncertainty there that the teams have to deal with, whether the means will be a little bit would be too unsatisfactory. Let's not get too deep into that plan. But there's no question that the changing conditions, the difficult to read conditions, you know, made for a spectacular race. It wasn't a situation where the rain suddenly comes down heavily and it's clear that you all have to go onto wet tyres. And sure, that will make for a more interesting race. That will shuffle things up a bit. It'll shake it up. And it gives drivers and teams plenty of chances to make mistakes, to get it wrong. But those conditions where, you know, for quite a long time, the drivers and the teams are really having to make a fine judgment about whether to go onto another tyre or not, whether the track conditions are going to come back to the tyre that they're on at the moment that isn't quite right now, and, you know, can we hang this out for another five laps? You know, will we lose just too much time over that period that actually we need to make a change now? It allowed the cream to rise to the top. You know, Hamilton is a master in changing conditions when the grip is coming and going, and you've got to make a very, very difficult judgments, and you've also got to deal with difficult changing conditions. He's an absolute master there. He and Mercedes made the right decisions at the right time, and then critically at the end of the race he was able to hang on and keep his lead on Verstappen and get that extraordinary, wonderful victory that, you know, I still feel, you know, I'm feeling the emotion actually sort of well up my, you know, when I talk about it just now, you know, I'm just getting a little echo of the joy in seeing him take the checkered flag.
It chokes me up as well, the melancholy quality of it. It being his return to glory, also being arguably his last hurrah with Mercedes. I don't know, that car seems to have come on in leaps and bounds, and Red Bull don't seem to have the advantage that they had previously. Could Lewis get more wins? And I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Silverstone is a fast circuit. You know, it'll probably do well on faster circuits, I'm surmising. I know it was the changing conditions and the right tyre choice that made the best of the situation and allowed him to win. But both those Mercedes were doing well. And poor George, oh, heartbreaking. George could and should have won that race too, if I'm fair.
Yeah, it's a great shame that the mechanical problem they had, cooling system, I think it was, a water leak.
Yeah.
It's a tremendous shame that that cost him the chance of a win and that we weren't able to see him in the mix at the end of the race. He had a tremendous weekend up until that point. But yeah, you know, Mercedes is resurgent as a team. You wonder whether with this win under his belt this year, whether that will give him a bit more of a boost and... and so, yeah, you know, why shouldn't he win another race this year? Mercedes are strong. He's still got it. He's maybe got a further confidence boost. You know, we'll see. But let's remember that there have been, you know, we've had, what, 5 winners so far this year?
I think it's, you're right, yeah.
At the same time that Verstappen and Red Bull, you know, are the combo to beat. They're still the combo to beat. It hasn't been, you know, the plain sailing that a lot of people might have expected them to have, and you know, they're having to really fight for the wins, and the Noro was winning that fight with Ferrari, with Mercedes, with McLaren. I think we're going to see that coming and going for the rest of the year. We're going to see, you know, multiple winners through the rest of the season, I think, from the drivers who've already won. I think we're not going to suddenly see Albon suddenly going to win a race, but you know, we're going to see plenty of good fighting.
Oh, Logan Sargeant is going to get at least 3 wins, isn't he? Hey, I'm no athlete, but I remember in school I was reasonably good at trampoline and gymnastics. And my trampoline teacher, Howell Hughes, lovely man, taught me how to visualise a move, you know, whether it was a Barani, which is like an open back somersault with a half a twist, that sort of thing. He taught me how to...
Right, I know exactly what you're talking about, says he, staring blankly. Yeah, continue.
He taught me how to do, how to visualise doing a move, and he would get me to do the move and fail. But I'd now got like 80% of the move, then all you got to do is visualise the landing. And he taught me to do that. And I think Lewis has been given the ability to not just visualise, but materialise, manifest a win by having achieved it once. He now knows this is possible. We can beat the Red Bulls. We can beat the McLarens and the Ferraris. But I remember a similar thing happened with Damon Hill when Schumacher beat Damon Hill. Schumacher was in a Benetton. And he was stuck in fourth gear. I can't remember where this race was. It may even have been the British Grand Prix. And Damon was kind of appalled that he could still be beaten by a man with a car that only had one gear. And they sent him out to drive a car in practice and said, right, you're not allowed to change gear. You've got to go as quick as you can. And he found that he could actually drive that car, not as quick, but still commendably quick, around problems. And that was that thing of visualising and then manifesting, making it physically happen. And I think Lewis has now got the bit between his teeth. I think the most important thing we're here is not just getting a win, but beating George to that win. I think that's a big psychological help to Lewis where he is at the moment, in my view. Would you agree?
I agree absolutely about what you say with the competition with George Russell. You know, Russell is a, you know, Russell is a star, and for Lewis to be able to get that win, you know, over Russell is, you know, when a lot of people talk about how, you know, maybe this is, you know, this is the tail end of Hamilton's career. Russell is now the team leader. He is now the man at Mercedes, and Lewis Hamilton is a falling star. No, this will absolutely put a bit of pep back in his step and give him that confidence. I just come back to, you used the phrase manifesting a couple of times. Don't get me started on that. I'm absolutely not, you know, I really don't buy into. I'm not a fan of this thinking, this way of, you know, this bullshit New Age way of thinking that you can manifest things by thinking about them. No, you can't. What you can do is increase your self-confidence, and you may be able to help sort of plot a clearer path towards some goal by thinking and visualizing about things. But no, you can't manifest becoming wealthy or achieving a success by thinking about it.
Okay,
that way.
Yeah. Well,
don't go in for that magical thinking. No, I'm sorry to come back so hard on that,
no,
but I'm just, you know,
Joe, come on.
I just have to, hey.
I get it, brother. I get it. Yeah. Listen, I had no idea that New Age people use the term manifest. I only haul that word out of my back pocket because I couldn't think of the word I was trying to find right now.
Honestly, I think it may be a bit more of a kind of sort of, you know, US business guru, lifestyle guru thing, rather than old school hippie New Age.
Right.
I don't care. It's bullshit anyway.
I was using it in its old grammatical
form. Yeah. Petty argument concludes.
I love it. I love it. I love talking to you. I pick up on things I've never noticed before, and it's valid. That's what the beauty of a relationship is. Listen, the other great thing that made me exorbitantly happy at the British Grand Prix was the fact that Nico Hülkenberg finished sixth. Come on!
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And K-Mag didn't have a bad race either, did he, actually?
Did he actually finish in the end? He certainly overtook Stroll later on in the race, I seem to remember. Let me have a look.
But yeah, very strong race for Hulk and Haas.
Kevin finished 12th.
Particularly when, you know, Ferrari had a bit of a disaster with Leclerc, you know, and the similarly engined Haas is showing them the way.
Yeah,
I mean, I wasn't quite clear whether it was Leclerc or the team that got it so wrong for him. He was on absolutely the other end of the Lewis and Max making the right call at the right time scale. On the wrong tyres at the wrong time, stayed out for too long on the Inters when they should have changed. Probably maybe shouldn't have changed the Inters when they did at one point. And so, yeah, that was a bit of a disaster for Leclerc, which is a great shame. I'd have loved to have seen him up at the front. This is the terrible thing when you're a fan of too many drivers, you want to see them all at the front. You want to see them you know,
well,
first, second, and third.
Curious you should say that.
You want to see them all on the podium. We need a bigger podium.
That's the solution. It's really funny you should say that, because going into this race, Indy, number two son, asked me, "Okay, Dad, you know, who do you want to win? What do you want the result?" I said, "Well, if George got it, that would be fair enough. If Lewis got it, that would be amazing. Norris deserves one. If Leclerc or Sainz got one, I, of course, would be thrilled." And exactly the same as you, there were no losers in this race. If any of those guys had won, it would have been glorious. But the very cherry on the trifle was Lewis, of all of them, taking it. That was gorgeous, wasn't it?
100%. It's a shame that it was maybe Verstappen rather than Norris coming back.
He was
chasing Lewis down at the very end there. Yeah, he didn't have his best race, which is a shame, again, given the form he's been on and given how well he's coming along. And I think he's got a tremendous attitude. He's so, you know, even-tempered. He's very good at soaking up the bumps along the way, you know, as well as enjoying the success. Let's just hope he carries on progress in the right direction for the rest of the season, because he's such a star and I'm a big fan.
Yeah, the season has come awake. Two races before it takes its summer holiday. But hey, better late than never. Edsel Ford Jr., Jr. the Third, you must be feeling very proud today.
Yes, that's correct. It's not every day that Ford Motor Company launches an entirely new car.
But this car's got a very old name.
Yes, this is the Ford Capri, the car you always promised yourself.
But the Capri that I always promised myself was a tail-happy, poorly built, poor man's Ford Mustang with a largely inconsistent handling bias and an engine built in Cologne or Dagenham. And it was a two-door low-riding coupe.
And this new Ford Capri is a well-engineered, blue-collar, Euro-sized Ford Mustang Mach-E with terrific handling, performance to spare, and was engineered in Europe. And is a five-door, high-riding, fastback SUV.
So how is it a Capri?
Easy. It's called Capri.
You're a joke on speed! At the top of the show, I said that this was going to be a happy one. And the first half's been particularly happy because of a very good result at Silverstone. I'm rather suspecting that the second half of the show is going to be equally happy, because joining us now is Alex Goy, who's had the last 2 weeks of utter joy. Am I right, Alex?
Hi. Yeah, I mean, it's been quite good. It's a bit more than 2 weeks. I was a little bit exuberant in my message to you, but it kicked off just before Le Mans and hasn't really stopped.
Let's work backwards, right? We're going to go to the earliest car that you drove, because I think this could be the most interesting, exciting one. Let's work backwards, right? I should explain. You've driven five cars in the last 2 weeks. Four electric. One of them had an internal combustion engine. Let's start with the old-fashioned combustion engine one. It was an Aston.
Yes, it was the 1-of-110 Aston Martin Valour. 5.2-litre V12, more than 700 horsepower. 555 pound foot, 6-speed manual gearbox, rear drive, and a tweed interior.
No, really? Tweed, not leather. Yes. Actually, tweed. Wow.
Yeah, actual tweed.
I would not have guessed tweed from the exterior.
Well, you would not. But the one they had was the sort of Aston Martin design division, let's see what we can do with the car thing.
Yeah.
So they kind of pushed the boundaries, which is why the one I had was turquoise and it had a sort of red grille surround and it had tweed inside. Apparently they ran one particular tweed supplier out of a tweed and they refused to make any more of it because they were done with that tweed. So they've had to like bulk buy, I guess. I don't know. Yeah, it's a very cool thing. So the Valour, if you're not familiar, a few years ago, Aston released a one-of-one car called the Victor, named after Victor Gauntlet and inspired by vantages from the 70s and the 80s, and a race car called the Muncher, which was very brutalist and very chunky. That the Victor was part 177, part Vulcan in its makeup. So it had this amazing naturally aspirated V12 and its bones were basically a racing car. And then, yeah, last year at Goodwood Festival of Speed, Aston launched the Valour. Looks inspired by the Victor, but more than one person could have it. And it's 110 people, all sold now. I think they were all sold before it was revealed. Aston's been doing these specials for a while, but they did that those sort of those speedster cars. Now they're putting roofs on them. And I think they're going to be doing quite a few more. Chatting with the team, each of them are going to look different, drive differently, feel different. You know, the whole nine. So if you want to try and collect the lot, you can. Be a brave one, I shan't lie. You need a lot of money. But if I had that sort of money, I would have one of each of them as well, please and thank you. Because it was absolutely brilliant.
Given that they're all sold already, if I wanted to not buy one, how much would it not cost me?
Some million something. Lots.
Wow. Right.
Lots. Okay. Yeah, it's a seven-figure car. I mean, it's one of those things, like when I drove the Batteur, you know, your spec of this car is anything can be done if you want it to be done. You know, if you want a certain aspect in one colour, if you want a door panel in this colour and then a floor thing in that colour, if you want this material or that material, it's that kind of vehicle. It's bespoke, essentially. It's a bespoke Aston Martin suit.
And is it the best bespoke Aston Martin suit that you've ever driven? Or do you have others that you preferred?
I mean, I haven't driven the Victor and I haven't driven a 177, though I'd very much like to drive both of them. What stood out for this is how accessible it is. because it's a 700 horsepower car, which should be quite gnarly and it should be quite fighty and pointy. But actually, they say it's a driver's car, and that comes with some caveats for me, because when someone says, oh, it's a driver's car, that usually means it's a Caterham or a 911 GT3, so it's going to be uncomfortable, lumpy, and great when you're doing 10 tenths, but rubbish if you need to go and get, you know, a bottle of milk or something. Whereas this is, it's less a driver's car with a capital DRUV. It's more for people who enjoy the act of driving stuff. So the gear shift, for example, it's shortish, it's notchy-ish. You don't work super hard for it, but it's not like, you know, driving a Golf or a Ford GT70, which is just an absolute nightmare. The motor, the throttle response is just phenomenal. You fly and it makes a hell of a noise. And the look of the thing, you know, it looks incredible. The steering's perfectly weighted. Now, it was built by people who know what enjoying driving is like. It's not built for Apex, and they haven't released a 0-62 time quite deliberately, because they said it could be quicker if you put an auto in it, and it would be quicker. But soft, squishy thing behind the wheel means it slows. They haven't bothered with it. And the top speed is the fun side of 200 miles an hour, which, officer, I did not approach. Honest.
Glad to hear it. But the looks of the thing, I love that retro futuristic look that they've gone for. To my eyes, there's a oddly maybe a little touch of the Alfa SZ about it in the front end. Is that just me? I mean,
there's some boxiness to it.
But a good boxiness that sort of, you know, is a little bit of a diversion from the, you know, the slight sameness. It's a very lovely sameness, but the sameness of those Aston Martin lines that we've seen repeated over and over and over.
Yeah, I mean, what they wanted to get with this one is that sort of homage to Victor, which itself was an homage to lots of other cars. What they were saying was that they wanted to design something retro, but they didn't want to make it intentionally retro. So they had to forget everything about future design, but they also didn't want to make it look like they were just designing everything with a set square. So it's one of those strange cars where it looks kind of old school and kind of boxy, but then you get right up close to it and you realize there are lines and there are curves. They're quite subtle. It's got some really nice bits in it. My favorite fact about it is the grille surround, which is, you know, the typical Aston Martin grille. Here it's sort of inset into the grille itself, but it juts out, and it itself is a part of the crash structure, so it's the bumper, which is quite cool.
I have to say, looking at that grille on that car, which is a fleshy red surround around the horizontal silver grilles, it has a touch, and if I can use the Latin term, labia majoris and labia minoris about it.
I would say it's like the Aston Martin race cars of old. It's got the Aston lipstick. But if you want to say it makes you look like a twat, Gareth, feel free.
I didn't say that, but you could. The wheels are intriguing. This kind of honeycomb design.
Oh yeah,
yeah. I mean, those were a variation thereof. Have been around for a bit. Oh, there was a special edition DBS Superleggera to do with Honor Majesty's Secret Service that had very similar wheels. I don't think those are the exact same wheels. I think these are different, but Aston's had sort of that kind of busy, snowflakey pattern going on for a while on a fair few cars. And these, it sits on Cup 5s, which is, you know, Aston's the first manufacturer to have them as sort of an OEM tyre, debuted on, I think it's Cup 5s. Oh, hang on, there's some police going past. Thanks, crime. fucking London. I think Aston was the first to go with Michelin Cup 5s. They were first on DB12, they're on Vantage, and now they're on Valor as well, which is quite cool because they're a really good tyre.
I want to hear what you think about one of the other cars that you drove. I'm going to go from the most powerful to the least powerful. Now, this is a car that we talked about on the show before, but the one that you had this time was finished in a kind of a muted gunmetal green or ivy green. What would you call it? It's a Citroen Ami.
Yeah, well, it's a sort of plastic green is what it is.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
So, yeah.
Dark olive was what came to mind.
Oh, very
yes.
Cool.
Yeah. Dark olive. A very in-fashion colour this season, I've noticed, as I turned
right?
up to a party full of middle-aged, middle-class people wearing white trousers and green tops going, oh, shit.
Hey, did you like it more again than the Aston, the Ami?
For accessibility, yeah, actually, weirdly. So last year I borrowed a Citroen Ami, one with doors, the grey one that sort of swept the nation, $7,500, depending on which trim you get. There's one called a Tonic and a Pop and a something else. It depends on whether you get stickers and a spoiler or whatever in there, right? And then last year, Citroen announced that it was going to be doing a special edition called the Ami Buggy. And the Ami Buggy is just like the normal Ami, except it doesn't have doors. It's got two sort of steel tubes either side of you that open exactly the same way as the doors. It's all the same hinges. It's just less door. It's open. So I think that the idea of it really is it's for the beach, and it's for bombing around the Med and going from village to village in France. Not really for London in the sort of most autumnal July that I think we've ever
had. Yeah, same up here in North Wales. It's been, well, it's nice now, but it's been pretty freezing. Yeah, has it got a heater?
It's been quite miserable. But the Ami Buggy, its whole thing was that it came in this green with kind of copper steelies. And that's sort of the only difference. It doesn't have a fan. It doesn't have a heated screen or anything like that, because why would it? Like, the wind will sort that out. And you've got to hold on to your luggage because it might fall out. But other than that, it's an Ami without doors. And it's been hilarious. It's been absolutely brilliant because it's tiny. You can drive it flat out everywhere. The top speed is 28 miles an hour. However will we survive such velocities? It's like Stevenson's rocket all up in here. And it's just a very cool, happy thing. Though I did have a very mixed reaction to it. I was going to pick my partner up from a thing near me. And it was just at school kicking out time. So there was I in Miami Buggy, grey weather, a little bit of drizzle going on, and there are kids going, wow, Lego car, that's really cool, wow.
It is.
And then I went past a secondary school, and I was called a twat. So,
wow, without being in an Aston Martin.
Well, yeah, right. And without being in an Aston Martin, which is when it normally happens to me.
And the chances are that if you drove past both those schools in the Aston Martin, both would have said, wow.
Yeah, probably. I'd hope so.
Mind you, though, you know, hopefully those older kids will they'll come back round to the Ami, because I think it's a tremendous little vehicle. And yeah, that version, it's not the UK version. It's not really best suited for the London streets.
If you like the colourway, I think Citroen last week announced that there was going to be an Ami in that colourway, but with doors, which makes it kind of, you can have a grey one or a green one now, which I kind of dig. To be honest, I had a lot of conversations with it. I took it, there's a car meet called the Southside Hustle, meets up on Wimbledon Common, first Sunday of every month, 8 in the morning. Everyone's very lovely there. It's just a nice time. And I took it there, and loads of people were interested in it. Some people didn't understand it. So, well, I live in Surrey. I couldn't drive that to London. And they're kind of flabbergasted when you go, no, you can't, and you're not supposed to.
Yeah, horses for courses.
It's not a commuter car. Yeah. It's a car, you know. No, Zog, you and I live in the middle of London. We could quite feasibly get away with an Ami to nip to the shops and nip home and go and see friends and do all that. You know, we could have one of those.
Exactly. I mean, and you know, a lot of our favourite vehicles, and when I say our favourite, I mean not just, you know, the three of us who are talking now, but our petrol head listeners, you know, a lot of our favourite vehicles, you know, they don't do everything. You can't go and pick up the furniture that you've just ordered in your Caterham, you know.
No, I mean, I'm having to do some stuff moving in a week or so, and none of it will fit in the back of either my Aston or my Morgan. I'm going to have to borrow my friend's Honda Jazz for a day, and then hire a van for another day.
And we don't love the Caterham, you know, or the Aston, you know, or the Morgan, you know, any less.
No,
because we can't stick a sofa in the back. No, you know, very often the vehicles that don't do everything are the vehicles we love the most, and the vehicles that try to do everything end up being, you know, practical, perfectly good, but rather boring, sensible family runarounds, you know, that sensible Volvo Estate or whatever it is. You know, that will, that's a very, very, that will do almost everything you want a car to do, except, you know, go very fast around a track. You know, it's a car that, a vehicle that does everything is not going to do a single thing really well. And
no,
we tend to prefer the vehicles that do one thing really well, whether it's going around a track fast, whether it's going up a mountain in style, and, you know, and lasting, doing that and coming back down the other side. Simple as that.
All right, let's talk about another car then that, let's think. It's pretty practical. It's pretty fast. It's got four doors and it's electric and it's a Lotus. Is this the fastest four-door Lotus since the Carlton? It's about as different from the Ami as you can get. Talking about the Lotus, hang on, let me get it right. Emeya, is that how they say it? Emeya. Emeya. You say Emeya, I say Emeya, etc.
Let's call the whole thing off.
I had a look at one at Le Mans. There was one parked at Le Mans. It's a big, lovely, low electric saloon.
It's very big. And yeah, from the rear three-quarter, it's quite ungainly. Yeah, I mean, I drove the S and the R. The S has 600-odd horsepower. The R has 900 horsepower.
Wow.
The R tops out 160-odd, so it's a bit slower than the Lotus Carlton. The S isn't quite as herky as that. The R will do 0 to 60 in 2.8 seconds, I believe. Which for a car that is well north of 2 tonnes is quite a lot. I mean, the Electra SUV, I've driven one very briefly around Goodwood Circuit, and I drove a pre-prod a while ago around Hethel, so I've not driven one on the road. But the interior and the interior architecture, they're cut from the same cloth. The star of the show in that car is the software and how it all works, and as an environment for you to be in. So, you know, it's got a big screen and you can twiddle a car around on it and you can press things and windows will open and doors will open. You can change how translucent the sunroof is, the panoramic sunroof, because it's got that sort of echochromatic stuff in it, and you can make patterns. Sadly, you can't make a penis. I tried.
Hang on, tell us about this.
Well done for trying.
Yes.
We applaud you. We applaud you for bringing your research in car tech
hard-hitting
down to
consumer
a puerile level that we
right
can all
here
relate to.
What, you can draw a penis on the roof and
no,
it will
you
stay?
You can't draw a penis. So what it is, it's a big rectangle. Of
you can have a go at drawing a penis on the roof.
And it's divided into triangles, so you can sort of, you can have like half of it, or you can have various shapes in it. So you can't just run your finger along the screen and draw a knob on it. Sadly, you have to sort of make pretty patterns with it. It's quite cool. It's a neat little gadget, but once you've done it once, no one will really care. It's one of those things where it's like, I want my sunroof either open or closed. I don't want like a specific diamond to give a dappled pattern in the cabin. It mirrors, so the both the Emeya and the Electra have these sort of petals at the front, which are kind of they're dynamic airflow. So for battery cooling and various bits of the car cooling, when it gets hot, these petals open. It's they're nice little triangles and they look very cool. That's actual functional design technology.
Yeah.
I mean, Colin Chapman wouldn't be his jam because it's a lot of faff for what could just be a couple of vents, but it looks cool. And it's a sign of Lotus's new direction, which it has to take, I think.
And it's built in Wuhan.
It is indeed, which is about to make it incredibly difficult to sell in Europe, because on election night, the EU announced there's going to be tariffs for Chinese-built cars. Brilliant. America, not a huge fan of Chinese-built cars at all. Mm-hmm. And it's probably like 5 minutes away before the UK does something similar. So it's going to be quite a difficult sell for some people. But yeah, the interior is great. I think there were two specs on the launch. There was this sort of grey Alcantara and a cream or white leather. The grey Alcantara, very nice. It's a bit like being inside a sort of the minute house in Essex in some ways, because that's the colour of choice for accent walls. I mean, he says wearing a grey t-shirt today, but I can be a shady bitch.
I just painted my woodwork anthracite, and one wall dark grey and the other wall light grey. So yeah, I'm with
there
you.
We are.
Yeah,
there we are. It's a very of the minute colour. At speed, it's comfy. Like you can properly like when you're at speed, it's great. The thing about the R that a few of us noticed enough to be like, oi, what's going on here? When you're giving it a bootful, bear in mind it's got 900 horsepower and rear steer and all that nonsense. It's quite mobile. So you're sort of having to hang on a little bit.
Interesting. Driver's car.
To keep it in a straight line. Not to the point where you think it's going to, like, fire you off into a hedge. But it's nice to be involved in the process, but it's not necessarily always necessary. Oh, that's a horrible way of saying it. It's nice to be involved in the process, but it's not necessary all the time.
I don't know if this is related to that mobility that you're talking about there. Excessive mobility, but as a general observation, to me it's a little bit of a shame that Lotus is going in this direction of making significantly heavier vehicles. You say that this is, this weighs about 2 tons.
Two and a half, two and change, something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Their SUV is similar kind of weight, and there are no lightweight Lotuses on the horizon. I understand that with the embrace of electric drivetrains that they are going with, they're only going to be building these much heavier vehicles, no smaller, lightweight, I guess necessarily niche market vehicles.
Mm.
It is a bit of a shame, though, to me, that the name that was associated with performance through lightness, add lightness, was always one of Colin Chapman's core philosophies, that we're seeing such weighty vehicles being the direction they're going in. It's a bit of a shame to me.
It's an inevitability at the moment until Lotus, with their parents, Geely, come up with a super capacitor or something that weighs nothing and has the ability to retain all the energy that you need for a long journey and a quick journey. Until we get that technological leap, that just isn't going to happen, which is okay.
I mean, there's a lot of people decrying, saying, oh, Lotus is dead, woe is Lotus. I mean, it's still making the Emira. You can still buy a used Lotus. Yep. It's just Geely bought it and it wants to do a little bit of a Volvo with it and kind of reinvent it in the space that makes sense to it. But for them and for the direction Lotus is in, it's technological advancement. It's taking advantage of what's there and what's available. I mean, while it's not necessarily for the likes of us, Electras are selling. There are loads of them in and around my neck of the woods. I saw a bunch in Regent's Park the other day when I was on a job. Like, people are buying these things. So it's the case of, like, what's good for me isn't necessarily good for you and vice versa. And Lotus needs to survive. I mean, what would be worse? They build EVs or they don't exist anymore.
Well, it's exactly the same as the case with Porsche, isn't it, Zog? That the Cayenne actually paid for the rest of Porsche's sports car development program. And that the cars that Lotus are now selling to a conquest clientele, you might say, these are new people who would never have been able to buy a Lotus before, never wanted to buy a Lotus. They can buy a brand which they are aware of and they know stands for some level of excellence, but now it delivers them practical saloons, practical SUVs with a bit of panache and sporting. Okay, listen, we've got to crack on, boys. I would talk about Lotus and electricity all day, but I'm sure we will. But can we talk briefly about the penultimate of the four cars that you've driven, Alex? You drove a Mercedes Pagoda, what?
I drove a Merc SL Pagoda, but it's electric-y. It's been done by a company called Everati. I've spoken about those guys before.
Yeah.
Everati, I've driven their 911 before. It's 911 before. Sort of sprung up, conceptualised before, but sprung up mid-pandemic, a little bit after. It was really bad after 2020. And its job is to electrify and sort of redefine icons, if you want to do it in marketing speak. So whereas some companies, you can give them your classic and they'll tear out the oily bits and put a new powertrain in it and send you on your way, Everati, you say to them, hello, I would like one of your Defenders, one of your Series 2 Land Rovers, one of your GT40s, one of your whatever, in this case, an SL. And they'll go, cool. All right, you'll spec it up with them, and then however long later, and several hundred thousand pounds later, you will get a car that is built perfectly, built to a standard, beautifully restored, upholstered. Everati's whole jam is to make sure that the car that you get feels like the internal combustion equivalent.
Oh, so does this have a gearbox for some pointless reason again?
This one doesn't, no.
Good.
I don't think any of Everati's do. Everati keeps them automatic because it makes them simpler, whereas Electrogenic, you can have a manual if your car came with one, which is great fun. To be honest, a lot of people are going to think it's sacrilege, but it was kind of perfect for an SL. It was smooth, it was quick, it looked good, like the restoration job was incredible. And as I said to a man in the street who was like, electric, well, that's horrible, you can't do that to your car. I was like, well, don't do it to yours then.
That's the correct answer. That's all you have to answer. Two questions on it. How much? What's the range, about 110 miles or something?
300,000 pounds, I think.
Wow.
Some hundreds, thousands of pounds. And the range, they're working 150, 200, I believe, at the minute. But that's going to go up because No, 150 to 200.
Oh, okay, that's what
50
more
to 100 would be mental for 300 grand.
Well, that's what I was trying to be polite about. All right, finally, we haven't got a lot of time, so give me your best 4 minutes on a car which I know probably make you cry, Alex. Tell us.
And I have only one question about this car, which you may be able to anticipate.
I know what's coming.
We were talking about Evirati. Now let's talk about Electrogenic, the ones that don't do full restorations but do basically powertrain swaps. That's its business. There are four arms to the business. They've got some cars out with the military, so electrified Land Rovers. They do kits, so you can buy a Mini and stick an Electrogenic kit in it, and there's an E-Type kit and a few others. There's some OEM concerns, and then there's Bespoke. And I drove its Bespoke division's latest project, a DeLorean DMC-12, for which there is now a kit if you want to do it. Yeah, so I drove a Lecky DeLorean, and it was ace. It was silly, and it was ace.
Of course it's silly. Why was it silly?
Why was it silly? Because if you guys remember Imperial, it came out, 79 to 82, just...
Yeah. Yeah,
they sold not as many as they'd hoped of it, and they were all a bit different, and it was all a bit higgledy-piggledy, and it came with that god-awful 2.85-litre PRV V6.
The Dovan block.
Which had a dizzying 130 horsepower because emissions reasons or whatever, and it was just a bit shit, and it was a bit slow. The car itself, everyone wanted it to be a sports car, and they said, it's a sports car. And DeLorean, especially the people that worked there at the time, were like, it's just a big cruiser. Which I've driven one with the V6. And if you stick it on an American highway and just say, go, you'll glide along at 70 miles an hour comfortably, calmly, happily. It was good at what it did. It's just the engine was a bit crap and they weren't very well built. And so someone has decided that they want to make theirs electric.
And my one question about this electric conversion is, does it have a 1.21 gigawatt motor?
No.
That's the question.
No, it does not. It has... Hang on, you've kind of put me on the spot, because I need... Let me find it.
it'll be in the... hundreds of kilowatts.
I'm going to say 70 kilowatts.
100 to 2...
Is
150 kilowatt energy. Anyway, I asked the question because
it's 160 kilowatts.
160 kilowatts.
Okay, there
That's
we go.
Plenty.
Because as any fool know, in Back to the Future, the time traveling DeLorean has a 1.21 gigawatt.
Great Scott!
What a movie.
The speedo goes up to 85 though, because of federal laws.
As it usually
won't do 88 miles an hour.
Yeah, that was the law up until about 1986 or something, where speedos only went up to 85. I think they go way beyond that now, but I remember that. And headlamps had to be a certain height above the ground, and everyone had to drive at 55 miles per hour. The double nickel. I remember that period in America's history. Have we forgotten? It was the late 70s to the early 80s. So, come on. It's going to vastly outperform the original heavy, pathetic Dovan block with its electric
motors. So it weighs about 40 kilos-ish more than the petrol one. The engine's in the back. The frunk's still a frunk. It's got 40-something kilowatt-hours battery. So it's not small, but it's not massive. They reckon you'll get about 150-ish miles of range out of it. It will do 0 to 60, they say, in 5 seconds, and I can believe that. It's quite quick. It's very, very fast.
And was it eventful?
It's definitely quicker than the original.
Because it's got something like 230 pound foot, and the car itself doesn't weigh that much in the first place. So yeah, it is quick. I can believe it would do silly speeds. You know, whether I'd want to take it to 130 miles an hour, I don't know. I probably wouldn't.
The rest of the vehicle hasn't been upgraded with, you know, better brakes and suspension or anything. It's just like-for-like replacement with an electric motor, I guess.
Pretty much, yeah. So the brakes are the same. It's got a bit of regen on it, obviously, because the powertrain. And the suspension is the same, which means you can get up to some quite rapid numbers. And then when you go in for a corner, the whole thing leans incredibly heavily.
Oh.
But what I would advise the chap who owns that to do is maybe put some better springs on it. You know, you can keep it damped nice and softly, but just it doesn't need to lean quite that much, because you get out of a corner and it just keeps leaning. It's like you're banking a Spitfire. It's ludicrous. Oh, it's excellent fun, but it's very much 80s dynamics with 2020s power.
Do you know what? Right, just thinking about it, of these four cars, the Pagoda that you drove that was electric, the Ami, the Aston Martin Valor, and the Lotus Emeya, how do we say it again?
Yes, yeah. The Emeya.
Yeah, this is most closely related to the Emeya, because you think about it, it was a Lotus platform that the DMC-12 was designed around, wasn't it? Oh, it was designed by Lotus for DMC, and it's an electric Lotus in the way that the
Emeya is. It was designed sort of by Lotus. It's the story is long and complicated, but Colin Chapman was involved, but Lotus, I don't think officially what it's all...
I see. It wasn't Lotus Engineering, yeah. It was just Colin. Right, okay.
Well, it was sort... It's a very, very long-winded and very, very interesting story that will have you thinking less of a lot of people.
And what... of course, yes, they were dark times, that story. I wish we had time to talk about it now, but, boys, we've got to wrap it up. Alex, thank you so much for sharing the joy. Me, of those four cars, I think I want to drive the DeLorean Zog. Which one do you want, briefly?
I'll go with the Aston.
Of course you would. I thought you were going to go with the Citroen, but, hey, can't be right always.
I love the Ami, but that Aston Martin looks a little bit special.
You know what? It is.
And so are you two. Bye-bye, my special friend. Say bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, fellas.
If you enjoyed this show, then please like, share and subscribe. For information on how to contact the show, see pictures, read song lyrics, follow us on social media, or to sponsor this podcast, go to garethjones.tv. Gareth Jones on Speed is made in Wales by Whiz Bang.
Gareth Jones on Speed!